When I was in junior high, I was baptized. And it wasn't because I made this personal, deep spiritual decision. It was that I heard about hell and it didn't sound very good. And so I made this decision. I didn't want to have anything to do with that place. So I went to my grandpa, who was a priest, and he arranged for a private baptism. Now, that is against the rules in our church, because when you are baptized into the family of God, and not just we do something privately. So we only do that under special circumstances. I don't think this was a special circumstance as much as he just wanted a family party afterwards. We did the baptism. I have to say I did a great job. I was awesome at it. I learned all the words ahead of time because I was afraid that if I did something wrong, it wouldn't take. And so I was really afraid of saying the wrong words. So I made sure I had the service memorized, and I actually said I renounced them rather than something else, you know, in those moments. And so, you know, it's cute when it messes up and it's a baby and they scream, but it's not as exciting it's plenty exciting when somebody screams as an adult during a baptism, but for totally different reasons. So we did this, my family was all around and we had this baptism and there's pictures of me and I look adorable. And then afterwards we went out to lunch. Now, this is in San Juan Capistrano. We went to a restaurant that's been around for years and years and years. It's a Mexican restaurant, and their claim to fame is that it's Richard Nixon's favorite Mexican restaurant. Now, I don't think that that's a very good endorsement, personally. I just think that the last endorsement that you've gotten, the best one, is from Richard Nixon. That doesn't need to be on all of your t-shirts and menus and everything. But that was the big deal, and they had the Richard Nixon table as he ate here, and it was probably bugged. And we're sitting down and we're with the group, and it's this special family day, and my cousin is visiting from Colorado, and he's there, and he's a couple years younger than me, and he gets up and he just goes and walks around, and I thought it'd be a really funny joke to put a little bit of salsa in his water cup, which was a really funny joke. You can all admit that. You can all say that. So I did this thing, you know, and he comes back to the table, and all of a sudden it became like a sitcom moment, because he sits there and he drinks it and spits it all over the table. And all of a sudden everyone's looking around, and they look at my cousin here, and he says, "There's something wrong with my water." And I everyone's going, what's happening here? And I thought it would be really funny to put a little bit of salsa in this water. Gasps from the family at this moment. Everyone is just absolutely shocked. Clearly, the baptism didn't take, they're have you no shame, and I can't believe on the day of your baptism, judgmental aunts that I didn't even know I had are popping up and saying, "I can't, oh, this is for shame on our family that he's doing this on the day of the baptism." And so to this day, I'm not totally sure if it really took. There was talk of re-sprinkling me immediately following this event. The scriptures today are a lot of fun. I'm glad that I get to preach on them. I love this translation. We switched to it about 2 years ago. And one of the things we do during our vestry meetings is that we do a Bible study. And what I always start with is what words or phrases popped out to you as we were reading it. Some ones that really popped out. I love this in the Colossians reading for the bottom of the page, that it talks about staying away from any empty philosophies and high-sounding nonsense. I love that. I love that phrasing. And there are so many of those that pop out, and there's one in the gospel I really want to talk about today. So Jesus is with his disciples. He has been praying. And they come to him and they say, "Teach us to pray just like John's disciples did." Now, this is a weird phrasing in itself. And it makes me think that they're after, they kind of want to play disciple. Like, John's disciples taught him this stuff. You teach us how to do this kind of things. We want to play disciple too. Isn't this what you're supposed to be teaching us? But the other thing that's really interesting to me is when you compare this to what else is going on in the world about Jesus, a request to teach us to pray, it's kind of weighted, okay? There are all sorts of other deviant and differing schools of theology and philosophy going on in Jesus' day. You've got people who believe that the way to salvation is through ritual purity. We call them the Pharisees. We talk about them a lot around here. You've got folks that have decided to renounce everything and live this life of kind of hermitage. You know, there's groups like the Essenes, if you've ever heard of them, the Dead Sea Scrolls folks. You've got the Cynics. You've got folks like that that have decided what they want to do is shriven. We want to be shriven of these things. We want to whittle down our life so that we have nothing of earthly value. And of course, they become of no earthly good at the same time. You've got folks who believe that salvation comes through secret knowledge. You've heard of the Gnostics. And these are people that believe that there are some sort of secret language or secret codes in order to sort of animate God to do what you want him to do. And the whole idea with this is that you can control God through a secret knowledge. It persists today. You remember the book, The Secret? It's kind of that same idea. There is a secret, and we can teach it to you for enough money and commitment, right? And by the way, if anybody says that they have a secret, or the Bible has a secret that we don't know about, run in the other direction. I had a seminary professor who said, if you have a new idea on what something means in the Bible, you are wrong. And I think that that's absolutely true. Why would God choose to not reveal it through the centuries? So you've got this whole idea of a secret and empowering language or wording, and I think, while they don't totally say this, part of what the disciples are asking is, teach us the secret of prayer that is most effective to have God do what we want him to do. Now, some of that is okay. If we are so fully aligned with God's will that we want only his will to be done, fantastic. But if we are seeking something that is maybe outside of his will, but something we really, really, really want, that's probably a wrong request. And so when the disciples come to Jesus and say, teach us the secret of prayer, what Jesus does is not give them any kind of secret, but instead teaches them to pray in a way that completely reprioritizes their entire lives. It doesn't start with, God, give me what I need. It's that you're in heaven and your name is holy and your kingdom, let it come now. Your will be done. And it's only after that reprioritization that God teaches them to ask just for what they need today. And let us not yield to the temptation of evil. You see, this is a prayer that's not about teach me the secret so I can get what I want. It's a prayer that your will would be done, God. And Jesus goes on, and I love this parable, and I heard some giggles, and I kind of loved that going through this, because it's really kind of funny. You know, a man doesn't have any food in his house, and there are specific rules of hospitality. We've talked about them in the last couple of weeks. That you just don't do that. When Abram is joined by God, this visitor to his tent, he bows down low and cooks for him. He makes sure that a meal is prepared. It's the same thing with this neighbor that's there, and he's knocking on the gate, and he's saying, hey, I need some food. I've got guests coming, and I don't have anything in there. You know, he's really concerned. This is offensive to his guests. And the neighbor, because everybody loves sleep, is kind of angry that he's being interrupted. And he says, the gate's locked, the lights are out, we're all asleep, come back later. Go away, I'm not going to help you. And the knocks keep going. hey, seriously, this is a kind of an important situation here. Is there any way that you could help me with the bread? Go away, I'm sleeping. And it keeps going. Now, as a father of two young children, I know that it's okay to bend the rules when sleep is on the line. And so I know that if they're asking for something and normally I'd say, you know the rules, all rules fly out the window if I can get a couple more minutes of extra sleep. And so I think that's what's happening, and I think you all giggled because you understand rightly that this man, this neighbor with the doors all locked up, only gets out of bed, not because of friendship, but because he knows he's not gonna sleep with this guy yelling in the street all night. And so he lets him in, and this is the phrase that I love that just popped out at me as we were going through it. That the neighbor opened the door because of this man's shameless persistence. I love that, shameless persistence. Now, if somebody were to refer to you as shameless, how would that feel? Not so good, right? That's not what you really want to be said about you. Have you no shame? As if shame is something that is intrinsically good to have, because otherwise it keeps you from doing all sorts of social stupidity. But if somebody calls you shameless, that's not really a good thing. It's that they recognize you should have shame and you don't. And you know, I think the whole idea is that this man who's calling out to his neighbor really has no right interrupting. He should be embarrassed about this. And it's the same thing with prayer in a lot of ways, because the idea is, what right do we have to even ask? But when you hear Abraham talking to God this morning, you kind of feel that, don't you? Like, God, you'd spare these people if they're 50, right? Yeah, I'd spare them if they're 50. Okay, now, I know I asked this, and I have no right to ask, but 45? Yeah, 45, that's good. Okay, now I know I'm way past the line even asking here. I'm embarrassed, I'm sackcloth and ashes, I'm dust, to dust I'll return, all this. But 30? And it keeps going in that way, like, God, forgive me, I shouldn't even ask, right? And there's almost this sense of, you know better, and we have nothing that we can offer up here. Have I no shame even asking these things? Shame is this powerful emotion, and it's almost spiritually inherited. You think back to the garden, took one sin, and the people looked down and they said, I'm naked, and they hide. They hide from God because they are ashamed. And as soon as God comes and talks to them, they're blaming one another, and there's division. Division between us as humans, division between us and God. And there's shame, and it builds up, and we continue in, and with every generation, we get further and further divided from God because of our shame. Think Isaiah in the temple saying, I'm ruined because I'm unholy. That is a division between God and humanity that really should not be broken up from a human perspective, because we'd be ruined. And so we have built up all of this shame. And ultimately, that's what seems to divide us between God and ourselves. And so when you really reconsider what shameless means here, think of the two ways that you can be shameless. One, you could be wrong and completely delusional and not recognize that you should be ashamed of yourself. Or, in Jesus' case, you have nothing to be ashamed of. There is no shame and no division between us and God. And this is what Jesus imparts. This is what Jesus teaches us about prayer, is that we have no shame if we are in Jesus Christ. Because of what he did on the cross, we have inherited shamelessness. And so we can come before God, and I love what the scripture says, that we can boldly approach his throne. And have we no shame? Exactly. Because in Jesus Christ, we are washed clean. We have no shame, and we do not have to come to the Father through any kind of mediator other than Jesus. We don't have to offer special sacrifices or give any kind of secret knowledge. Because in Jesus, we have no shame. And I want you to remember this as you pray to God, that you are shameless in his eyes. Now, I know Christians, good God-fearing and God-loving people, that could be hanging on by the skin of their teeth days to destruction. And you ask them, can I pray for anything? And they will go red in the face and say, he's busy. I don't want to bother the good Lord with this. But don't you feel that the Father would want to know? This is a loving Father who was willing to come down and die for us. Wouldn't he want to know what's breaking your heart, what's troubling you? And we have no shame as we approach him. And so some of you, if you're holding on to that and you're saying, you've got this very uncomfortable relationship in prayer with God. Maybe it's really formal. Maybe you have to say the right words in order for it to be effective. Let me ask you, what's that about? Have you no shame? Exactly. He loves you so much. He wants to hear from you. He wants you close. And we can approach him shameless, without division. Let us boldly come before his throne. And when we go into our prayer time today, I want you to try to do something that maybe for some of you, you've never done before. I want you to call him Dad. I want you to imagine yourself sitting at his feet as a father would his child, or as a child would his father. And I want you to imagine, rightfully imagine, that there is no division. Let us pray.